Back to school starts now. Get long-lasting battery life on the Dell XPS laptop powered by Series 3 Intel Core so you can work from anywhere. Now starting at $699 with exclusive student pricing starting at $599. And it's lightweight, portable, and packed with enough processing power to make multitasking a breeze. So say goodbye to distractions and hello to more free time because you've finished your work faster. Complete your setup with savings on select monitors and more must-have electronics and accessories. Limited time deals and free shipping on PCs and more await you at dell.com/deals. That's dell.com/deals.
This could represent certainly the best chance of the season that McLaren's had. It's almost like a restart to the season.
I think we'll see this weekend if they can fight for the title.
Even if Miami goes in Kimi's way, I don't think it should be panic in the Russell camp. I think they just need to, more than anything, is stay cool, stay calm.
Miami, we did see last year, Kimi was really quick. I'd expect him to be really quick again. Kimi's got a lot more to prove just yet.
Formula One is going back to Turkey. Istanbul Park is a brilliant racetrack, a modern-day classic.
It's such a cool circuit. It's super intense. I'm pleased to see it back.
F1 is back, and everything could be different. McLaren, Ferrari, Red Bull and the rest have had a month to study data and develop upgrades in the hope of catching Mercedes. The Silver Arrows, of course, will have been working hard to stay ahead. So what are we going to see in Miami? That's what we're here to try and predict. I'm Tom Clarkson, and welcome to F1 Nation, where I'm joined by former F1 driver Jolyon Palmer and IndyCar race winner James Hinchcliffe. Guys, after 5 weeks away from racing, it almost feels like the start of the season again. Is that how it feels for you?
Well, we're previewing a Grand Prix, TC, which is a nice change, isn't it? We're getting back going again, thinking about competitive orders, trying to rejig our brains on what's happened so far. Those three races feel like so long ago, don't they? So it's nice to be winding up for Miami.
And Hinch, how do you think the drivers will have been using this 5 week break?
Well, if you think about it, they had one of the shortest off seasons they've ever had. So I'm sure in a lot of cases they were, especially after the stress of the start of the season, so much information, so much different, so much learning. I'm sure a lot of them took the first part to really just rest, reset, recoup, give the brain a bit of a break. But then certainly as the engineers and everybody back at the factories have had a chance to really deep dive into the data, which is hard to do when you have those back-to-back or close races early on, a lot will have changed. They'll be back in the simulator preparing, a lot of upgrades coming, you know, as we know. So I imagine the first half was a nice and much needed break. And the second half of this unofficial spring break has been absolutely flat out as everybody prepares for Miami.
Well, you mentioned upgrades, but let's start with a quick summary of what else has changed for Miami, because the FIA, F1 and the teams have agreed changes which should see the drivers going flat out in qualifying. Other changes are aimed at avoiding big speed differences between cars at the start and during the race. And being an F1 sprint weekend, it's been decided to make the first and only practice session of the weekend half an hour longer to help the teams and drivers get used to the changes before they go into sprint qualifying. So with all that in place, we're going to find out which team has done the best work over the break. Could we see a change in the pecking order? Why don't we start, guys, by then looking at the track? How different are the characteristics of the Miami International Autodrome to anything we've dealt with so far this year?
I'd say they're probably another step into difference, really. I mean, you've got Japan, which is probably the biggest outlier. Melbourne's a real outlier as well in terms of the amount of recharge opportunities and all of those long flat-out sections. But Miami's got some really long straights. So they would have had three DRS zones of old, which sort of tells you kind of how important those long straights are. And they're really beltingly long. Full throttle out of the last turn as well, down towards where you go flat out through the final right-hand swerve before you hit the brakes for the first corner. So there is a lot of flat-out sections, a lot of straight-line speed. Therefore, you're going to need to recover still plenty of energy. In between it, there's big stamps on the brakes, though. It's not like a Japan in that way so much. China, you've always got one massive stop, but then the few of them in between are not so much. So I would say Miami is probably, although it's kind of a street circuit style, it feels like it's actually fairly regular compared to what we get now in the bulk of the season, I'd say, Hinch.
Yeah, I do think that highlighting the street circuit part of it is important, though. I mean, I know that, that Melbourne's sort of a temporary track, but there is grass. There are some runoffs. Miami, there is not. There are, you know, it's walls. It's going to be punishing drivers that that have mistakes. And in that section, those S's sort of in that first sector there, there are some kind of blindish corners, which, you know, we've talked a lot about some of the closing rates. And this is going to be one of the first tests, I think, of is anybody going to get caught out by that when you have a little bit more of a racetrack with some blind corners? Not as bad as Jeddah, but yeah, first time we're surrounded by concrete. It's going
to
be interesting.
And every time we come to Miami, that first sector, we're always like holding our breath, probably through qualifying when they're winding it up for the maximum. And you can abuse so much of the curbs through sort of turns three, and then you get into six, seven, and eight, the triple left. And you can hurtle so much speed on the way in there. And I still think we're going to see that with this generation of car. Obviously, less downforce. They're a little bit more lively. But you can still find a lot of time on the way in and then just be patient for that throttle, because the corner exits around this circuit are kind of even more critical than we've seen so far.
I always look at turn one in Miami. Pretty much every race we've had there, there's been some kind of drama with the five-week break preceding this race. Do you think that's an invitation for, I don't want to use the word carnage, but for incidents, at least on lap one?
I like the idea of carnage, to be honest, TC. I think you've got this kind of a short run, but then we have seen so many interesting starts anyway, to say the least, with someone having a shot down the inside, which could be really dirty because it's a temporary circuit. You don't often rubber in that inside line. And it's not obviously used the rest of the year round. So it gets really dusty offline. You then start braking from the inside. You're trying to go for a move. You snatch a front tire and then you're pinballing in towards someone else. And it's kind of getting your braking point for that first turn is going to be really difficult. And when you consider the first corners that we've just come from, Japan, China, they're very, very different. They're not big stamps on the brakes. They're not about judging your brake. It's about judging your confidence and your throttle liftoff. Here, if you're missing a little bit of brake pressure, if you're missing 5 meters on the brakes, it's going to be an incident. So it's a different challenge.
And I think the other thing to consider, right, is we've seen very different launch speeds from cars. So you're going to have, I think, a little bit more of a differential in speed before you even get to that brake zone, which is then obviously a bit more substantial than what we've seen. So, yeah, as you say, carnage could be on the menu.
They're tricky when you've got some people sort of looking in the mirrors all the way into the first corner. You've got other people just charging forwards, looking for more and more places. When everyone's uniform at a start and you're sort of row four and you think you're going to be seventh and eighth, if it's great, you go sixth. That's sort of one thing. You've got to judge one or two cars. But with the starts that we've seen so far this year, you've got cars that are gaining 3-4 positions, even more from further back. And so you have got space of the track where there might be no one, and then a space of the track where you might be four wide into that first corner.
Do you expect grip levels to be different now that we've got F2 there this year for the first time?
Probably help a little bit. It's another single-seater series with Pirelli rubber as well that will help to clean up the racing line. It's always better to have your F1 feeder series there. It's also, you know, less local traffic that's going to be out there dropping anything on the racing line, dropping oil or anything else. So it'd be better, maybe marginally.
All right, let's look at the pecking order then. Let's start by looking at McLaren versus Mercedes, right? McLaren have won in Miami for the past 2 years, and their technical director of performance, Mark Temple, told us on this show he thinks Mercedes are beatable. McLaren team principal Andrea Stella says the team is bringing a completely new car to Miami. So is this the race where McLaren get their first win of the year? Do you rate their chances?
I mean, it's almost like a restart to the season. As you mentioned earlier, with this amount of time off, the information, all the data that the teams have from the first three rounds, we know that everybody is bringing a lot of upgrades. It's yes. I mean, yeah, the short answer is yes. I think they have as good a shot as anyone in the top three teams. We have to remember that Mercedes has been very quick here as well the last few years, especially, Kimi Antonelli's performance here last year was incredibly impressive. But this could represent certainly the best chance of the season that McLaren's had, just because it is a little bit of a reset. And, you know, historically, they have run well here.
They feel confident heading to this race. All the talk is new car. They've preset Miami as an upgrade chance anyway, which they did a couple of years ago when Norris got his first win with a massively upgraded car. And they've done a similar thing this year. I think they knew they were on the back foot on the back of last season, pushing so hard for the title. So they sort of were getting through those first races, and then Miami was going to be a target. Now, it's obviously better for them that the two Middle Eastern races didn't happen, because they've got that deficit. I don't know if they'll win. I don't know if they'll be able to fight, but they have got the Mercedes power unit that they're getting closer and more on top of. And that extra 30 minutes of free practice, I think, could be so important for them with the amount of upgrades we're expecting on the car. I think we'll see this weekend if they can fight for the title. I think we'll see really if they're going to be close enough, because if they don't make enough strides here, then I don't think they'll catch up over the year.
That's really interesting. So you think the pecking order that we see in Miami will set the form book for the rest of the year?
It will set the form book for the next chapter of the year, which is you've got Miami, then you go straight to Montreal, another sprint weekend. Different circuit, but again, there's not going to be, I don't think, another big raft of upgrades coming. There'll be small tweaks probably in this couple of week gap. Monaco then, again, massively different circuit, but not one that you're going to bring big upgrades to. And then you get back towards the sort of European calendar and the conventional racetracks. This is the month where if you've been having issues and you've got the chance to get on top of them, which is a few teams have had these developments in the pipeline and now they can unleash them. I just feel like if they're still chasing it by a considerable, you know, a quantifiable margin, I feel like they're going to be, they're already with 100 points nearly deficit to Mercedes. The drivers are sort of 50 points away from the lead. If they're taking more deficit in the next couple of races, I don't think they'll make it up.
Does that apply to George Russell as well? Let's look at that intra-team battle at Mercedes now. The deficit between George and Kimi Antonelli leading is 9 points. Kimi's won the last two races. Of course, George is going to pull the line. It's a long season. We've got a long way to go. But does he need to stop the rot? Is that how he's going to approach this? It's a crucial race, particularly as Antonelli, as Hinch was just saying, was so quick here last year. He's got to turn the tide, right?
He does, but I don't think it's quite as pressing time-wise as people are making it think. You know, we're in round four. There's a lot of racing to go. Just look back last year. After the summer break, you had a 34-point deficit between Piastri and Norris. And by Mexico, Norris had taken the championship lead back. So a 9-point gap in Miami, I don't think should stress anybody out. Yes, you don't want Kimi getting too much confidence. You don't want him winning in every type of circuit and getting on too much of a roll. But I even if, sort of like Piastri had that string of tracks that didn't suit him particularly well in the latter part of last year, and it sort of, you know, added to the drop in performance right as Norris was peaking. If Kimi is particularly good at Miami, fine. Is he going to be good at Montreal? We don't know. He did okay there last year. But so did George. He did better, right? So again, even if Miami goes in Kimi's way, I don't think it should be panic in the Russell camp. I think they just need to, more than anything, is stay cool, stay calm, do what he does. He's been driving so well at the tail end of last year. I mean, really all last year, start of this year. Everything Kimi's done well, he has done very well, but there have been little asterisks beside both, you know, China and Japan. So if I'm Russell, I'm trying really hard not to panic, because he and the team are doing great. They just need to focus and not let the success Kimi's having, you know, kind of get to them.
What was the asterisk next to Antonelli's win in Japan? I understand the China one, in that George had problems in qualifying and Kimi got the pole and then took the win. But what was it in Japan? Because Kimi was quicker than George pretty much all weekend, as far as I could make out.
Right, but the safety car.
Oh, well, sure. But I think as much as the result, it was the speed of Antonelli that will have worried George, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he definitely had pace. And once he got to the front, it's not like anybody was going to touch him. But, you know, George was dealt a bad hand in the race. Even the speed throughout the weekend is almost irrelevant, right? The race is what matters. And in the race, he was ahead before that all happened. So, I do think there is still a little bit of a, you know, of a footnote on that one as well.
But also, guys, if you're sort of saying stop the rot for George Russell, He's had, what, a second in China with a big asterisk or double asterisk, and then a fourth. Okay, not the best race in Japan. And the pace there was definitely towards Kimi. But before that, he's been cleaning up everything. He's been winning everything. He won the sprint. You know, Kimi very nearly crashed out of the sprint in China. He very nearly didn't even get into qualifying in Melbourne. So it's been fine details that generally have gone Kimi's way so far. But I don't think George is thinking that he needs to stop the rot or anything as dramatic as that. I kind of think, if I'm George, you've got to stay so calm. Miami, we did see last year, Kimi was really quick. I'd expect him to be really quick again. Sometimes as a driver, you just gel with a certain track. You know, going back to somewhere where you had a sprint pole last year as a rookie, you're going to have confidence. You know exactly where you can throw all of those curbs I was talking about in the first sector. A lot of them about attitude of the car as you go over the curb, making sure you're not unsettling it, making sure you're taking exactly the right point to the inch. Otherwise, you can have these big snaps that then take away the confidence. But if you start with a lot of that confidence, you can chip away, particularly on a sprint weekend. And George has got to think, maybe the guy is going to be quicker again here, but do the best I can. And then there will be certain tracks coming up that if he can't win in Miami, which he might do, I think he'll get back into his stride again. Kimi's got a lot more to prove just yet. He's gaining confidence, but I think there's so much more for him to prove.
And you think George has the patience and the maturity now to think like that?
I feel like he does at the moment. I feel like there's a difference when I look at George compared to Lando last year, where I think Lando felt like there was more pressure on his shoulders with just the way that he was speaking, the way that he was saying he's not comfortable with the car. He arrived in China having won in Melbourne, but he was still saying, oh, I'm not feeling the love from the car. George is shoulders back. He is waltzing down the paddock. He is still, you know, the confident air in him. And I think every time he turns up at the moment, he thinks he's going to win. It didn't happen in Japan, but I don't see yet him having any sort of pressure on his shoulders. Of course, it must be there, but I don't see that coming just after one weekend where he's been categorically outpaced. Maybe it'll come in a few races, but for now, I think he's still confident.
Back to school starts now. Get long-lasting battery life on the Dell XPS laptop powered by Series 3 Intel Core, so you can work from anywhere. Now starting at $699 with exclusive student pricing starting at $599. And it's lightweight, portable, and packed with enough processing power to make multitasking a breeze. So say goodbye to distractions and hello to more free time because you've finished your work faster. Complete your setup with savings on select monitors and more must-have electronics and accessories. Limited time deals and free shipping on PCs and more await you at dell.com/deals. That's dell.com/deals.
Shall we move it on to the red team, to Ferrari, second in the Constructors' Championship after these opening three races? Rumours of big upgrades being shaken down during a filming day at Monza. I mean, they've been quick. Both drivers have finished on the podium, but they've felt quite a long way off a win, in my opinion. Guys, do you think this five-week break has given them enough opportunity to really challenge in Miami?
I don't know. I think Miami's not going to be one that they're going to be expecting to fight for the win just yet. I know there's a big load of upgrades coming for them. That's exciting. I also, that they've had this confidence through the start of the season that they know something good is coming on the car. And this is probably going to be the arrival of it in Miami. The thing that I see with Ferrari is that they've already got a really good car. The chassis side, you know, that's where the upgrades are going to be coming, more and more aerodynamics. More downforce, hopefully more performance. But what they really need is a bit more grunt for Miami. And again, I talk about those long straights. I just think a little bit like they struggled in Japan on the three long straight sections there. I don't know if they'll be able to add enough downforce to what's already a really good car with everyone else, you know, McLaren bringing upgrades. I'm sure Mercedes will be moving forward as well. I don't know if they'll be able to completely overcome Mercedes at Miami. Maybe they will. We will find out. You know, we're all just punting. I do think Canada, and more particularly Monaco, are going to be their big chances to get into a race-winning frame.
And how much is that down to drivers in Canada and Monaco? I just look at Canada and look at Hamilton's record there, and of course Leclerc's record at Monaco. Do you think, are those tracks, Hinch, coming up where the guys in the cockpit can actually overcome some of the deficiencies in the car?
Yeah, I think that can make a difference, you know, and in the same way that we talk about Kimi potentially being really good at Miami and drivers just gelling with certain racetracks, for sure, you know, Canada's a special one for Hamilton for a lot of different reasons, always run very competitively there. And, you know, the man from Monaco, nobody is quicker around the streets of the Principality than Leclerc. So I quite agree. Coming into Miami, for whatever reason, even with as strong a start to the season as they've had, you know, we started with McLaren and Mercedes, and that still, to me, sort of seems like the battle that we're going to be seeing there. But come the following two rounds, absolutely, I think Ferrari can be up there, and with both drivers as well.
So the big thing for the next two is that recharging the battery is just going to be basically for free. Montreal, you've got some short straights, some punchy little straights, but you've got so many big braking events. It's always the sort of circuit where you're on the limit of cooking the brakes. And okay, into the final chicane, that's going to be, there'll be a little bit of derating into there, but basically you're going to be able to recharge the battery really easily. They're not going to be taking the loss that they've got on the straights too much. They'll have to swallow a little bit into the final corner, and that'll be basically it. For Monaco, there'll be nothing. It'll just be pure chassis performance. What have you got in terms of downforce and compliance? And right now, they look like they could be the class of the field there. So that's why I'm so excited for them in the next races. But for Miami, I think it'll be kind of proof of concept, get it working, sprint weekend. Again, use that extra 30 minutes, dial in, still hope that they can get these great starts and hope that they can challenge because they're not miles away. But it feels like it's more akin to the last few circuits in terms of how sort of power sensitive it is.
And what about the intra-team battle between the two drivers then? I mean, Hamilton seems so much happier with this regulation, this type of car, than he was at any of the previous 4 years. Do you think he can hold a candle to Leclerc, or do you think the edge is still with Charles like it was last year?
I think these next 2 to 3 races are really going to be the telltale sign, right? Because with everything changing for 2026, yes, he says he feels better in the car. It physically, visually looks better when he's driving, when you're watching, you know, the onboards or watching, you know, I know Julian mentioned it trackside in testing. But we do know even last year, you know, the Shanghai was a great race for him, right? So he's had some success at those races, and it's kind of repeated. I feel like last year, this is the point of the season where the gap really started to grow between him and Charles. And so if over these next 2-3 events, at a place like Montreal where we expect him to be very quick, if he can stay ahead and stay in the fight, then I think it kind of gives you the confidence that, okay, I can do this all year long if you're Hamilton. If he starts falling back, you know, if for some reason some of these changes, some of these upgrades make the car a bit more on the nose and it sort of goes more towards a balance that suits Charles' style, we could see a gap within the team start to grow. I'm not saying I think that's going to happen. I'm certainly not saying I hope that happens, but I think it's a little too early still to know exactly where that battle between the two of them is going to be.
Okay, but we're confident that Ferrari will be what? The third fastest team this coming weekend?
Minimum third.
Yeah.
The gap behind is just too big at the moment. And I guess the question is, how good is McLaren's upgrade package versus Ferrari's? Because they're basically just in an upgrade off heading to Miami.
And remember, Ferrari's been the team that's kind of had some of the cooler innovations so far, you know, heading into the preseason, throughout the first few races. Maybe we're all kind of sleeping on them as a team that could bring out actually the biggest and most impressive upgrades, because they have sort of had that trend so far this year.
Right. What about the battle behind the top three? Haas currently fourth, Alpine fifth in the Constructors' Championship. Both of those teams ahead of Red Bull, would you believe it? Now, can they stay there? Can they continue to beat the Milton Keynes team? What do you think, guys? Let's start with Haas.
They've said, you know, that they are really trying to front load their upgrades. So they're trying to blow as much of their development budget as they can, as early in the season as they can. They know there's some low hanging fruit there. They want to get that performance right away and then begin to understand, you know, where the performance is. That might give them the edge now, but who knows how that plays out down the line and whether that, you know, kind of penalizes them and holds them back later in the season. It's tough to tell. It is shocking to think that the smallest team on the grid could potentially outdevelop Red Bull over this, you know, this stretch. I know we can get to Alpine in a sec, but starting with Haas, they're ahead now. Can they stay ahead? If they are putting a lot of effort and like I said, in front loading the upgrades, you would expect almost them to stay there, at least in the short term. But with the pure size, the resource, the experience of Red Bull, I mean, you'd be shocked if it stayed that consistent pecking order and Red Bull stayed the fifth, sixth fastest team as this season progresses. I think it's been an incredible performance from Haas up to this point. I just don't know if it's sustainable.
They're not staying ahead of Red Bull. They just can't. Yeah. They just can't. There's been a lot that's gone wrong as well for Red Bull so far. A lot more has gone wrong for Red Bull than it's gone wrong for Haas. Haas have had a really clean run so far through the first races. Obviously, Behrmann's big crash, but he was already coming from a Q1 exit in Japan. When you look at Red Bull's season so far, they lost a load of points with Hadjar in Melbourne. Verstappen had to start from the back of the field. They lost more points with Max in China and Hadjar had a spin. And then Japan, they were still struggling for a little bit of pace and trying to get on top of things. They haven't had a clean weekend. As and when they obviously need to find a bit of performance, which they kind of had in Melbourne. So I believe they've got way more in their locker than they had in than they showed in China and Japan. They just got nowhere near the sweet spot of that car. Probably they'll be bringing a ton of upgrades as well for the next race. They've obviously already bought a few to Japan, which didn't really look like they paid off. But all they need is a clean weekend. And I think we'll start to see both, you know, Hadjar's done a really good job. He's been close to Max. He'll be getting a good chunk of points. Verstappen will start to be a menace, I think, for the teams further ahead again. I just can't see, as great as Haas have been, as good as Gasly's been in Alpine, it would be a shock if they could really take a fight to Red Bull so far. And the Red Bull power unit is good.
And you really feel that Haas and Alpine could have done with those two Middle Eastern races, right?
Yeah.
Before Red Bull hit their stride, they needed the points from those two races, didn't they?
With the resource that Red Bull have got, you don't want to give them a month to pour through data, work on the car, bring new parts. I know they've had a lot of people leave, and we did the whole podcast special about GP and the Exodus. They've still got it. There's a huge amount of resource there. And you do feel like that has to come out on top when it starts ticking. Over Haas and over Alpine. Alpine said at the start of the year they're going to bring big upgrades at set intervals. I believe one is Miami as well. So not quite as front-loaded as Haas maybe, but they're playing the long game this year. You know, maybe they can keep fighting Red Bull for the moment, but you just feel that as soon as Red Bull figure it out, they've got the sort of baseline to be much quicker than they've shown.
And looking at the driver performances, are Behrmann and Gasly standout performers for you guys this year?
I think Gasly for sure. I mean, Behrmann as well. I mean, they've both done an incredible job. You look at, you know, Haas's combined position to the points total, it's all but 1 point has been Behrmann. Gasly's you know, obviously done a great job as well. But for me, I mean, he's the one that I've kind of looked at more just because through the second half, well, through really all of last year, but certainly in the latter half of the season, I mean, it was so painful, you know, to show up every weekend for him knowing that we hadn't been upgrading the car and it was just going to be, you know, what's the damage limitation? And he's really taken this opportunity and run with it. Some very strong drives, some very strong performances, both on Saturdays and Sundays. So he's been a delight to watch. Behrmann, you almost expected it just because of how strongly he ended last season. But I think both of those guys have done a phenomenal job.
And they both seem so happy and at ease with life this year as well. Even speaking to them right at the start of the season, I spoke to Pierre in pre-season, he was so laid back and happy with, obviously knows that suddenly he's going to be fighting for points. But he's not a guy that's scratching his head about what on earth's going on. Of course, everyone's trying to learn. All the drivers are still, like the engineers and the everyone at the teams trying to work out how these things properly work. But he was just taking it all in, super chill. And Behrmann the same, figuring out things on the fly in the Australian Grand Prix, working out how overtake works to make his pass on Lindblad. And it took him, I don't know, 15 laps, which was more than he hoped. But he was also relaxed about it. And I do think that those two, they're the leading stars for their team at the moment. Obviously, Behrmann missed out in Japan, but generally, their standout performances have carried their teams up the order.
And do you think Behrmann will be suffering any side effects of his crash in Japan? He's said physically he's fine, but do you carry that mental baggage with you going to the next race?
Hinch is better to answer this one than me, that's for sure.
Well, Hinch, yeah, sure. Indianapolis. How were you the next time you went there?
Yes, I've definitely hit some walls in my day, JP. Thanks, thanks for that. But no, look, drivers were nuts. He won't carry any of that. The younger you are, the nuttier you are, and anybody's still willing to strap into a Formula One car and go racing's missing a little bit, you know. So it won't affect him at all. If anything, it'll make him a little bit smarter and a little bit more heads up on some of those potential situations, maybe parts on that racetrack that will potentially create those situations. Obviously, they've made some changes to try to mitigate the speed, you know, deltas that we've been seeing. But no, he's shaking that off. The knee's healed. The bruise is gone. He's ready to go.
And Colapinto is going to turn up in Miami full of emotion and adrenaline after his show car run in Argentina over the weekend. He's an emotional guy, a passionate guy. Do you think that will help him reach new heights?
Imagine he'll walk into Miami feeling like he is the next coming of Ayrton Senna suddenly, or Juan Manuel Fangio, let's say. You know, when the support he has from his local crowd is incredible, and that's when you're not in Argentina. So taking that show run in Buenos Aires must have been pretty spectacular for him. I mean, it's going to be, he'll have a bit of confidence, but in the end, there's been quite a big gap between himself and Pierre so far. So he'll turn up confident, but if you can't put it on paper, let's say even on the first run or two of free practice, you fall back into that rot. So he has to use that and thrive off that Argentinian energy straight away.
We've discussed Red Bull Racing already, but can we talk about Racing Bulls, who are just 2 points behind the big team? Execution-wise, they've been exemplary so far this year. They're bringing an upgrade to Miami. Just how much do you think they can achieve?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many unknowns heading into Miami. Like you say, I think from an execution standpoint, they've done very, very well, especially with two young drivers. You know, you've got Lawson with some experience, but certainly not much. If that's the veteran in your team, you know, that's saying something. And Lindblad is a rookie. I think the two of them have done a really good job dealing with all the changes, dealing with everything that's been new. But and then the team, again, like you say, has executed with the package they've got. I do not think it's as strong a package as a lot of the cars in front. The Red Bull powertrain, as Jolyn was mentioning earlier, seems to have actually been a kind of pleasant surprise for that team and the sister team. But it'll be interesting to see kind of where they stack up. Because again, a team without the resource of the Big Four, certainly not making the noise about the upgrades that they're bringing that, say, a Haas is. So I'm curious kind of where they stack up. It could be a weekend where they might actually fall down a little bit if they haven't kept up on that development side, or they've planned their developments a little bit more spread out over the next 5-6 races.
I think also they're a team that have probably come close to maximizing their potential in those first races, at least with one car each time. When you look through their results, 8th, 7th and 9th for Racing Bulls, when you think of the top guys being too far away, we're already speaking about Haas and Alpine being very strong, but Racing Bulls have always been there with at least a couple of points out from each Grand Prix. You had Lindblad absolutely flying at the start of Melbourne, really put it all together. Lawson has been really solid the last couple of races as well. I think the strategy has fallen quite nicely for him so far as well, in those, whether it's the sprint race and he's on the hard tire, pitting under safety cars in China and Japan, getting himself up the order when he hasn't really qualified in the top 10 there. Ironically did in Melbourne, but got a bad start. So I feel like they've maximized it. And if everyone else starts to get closer to their real potential, then they might find it a little bit harder to land back in the points. But we'll see. They've proven that they can have a good car that's giving the drivers confidence again, and they can develop it as well. So maybe they'll be ready to surprise again.
And what about Lindblad then? Stunning debut, as you say, in Melbourne. Is it useful to be able to press pause after three races, give you an opportunity just to reflect at what you've done, look at what you've got coming up, get yourself back into a proper sleep pattern, stay in the same bed for consecutive nights? And do you think this has come at a good time for him, this gap?
I think so. I'd have taken it, definitely. Because you hit the ground running and you're just like a sponge absorbing everything possible in Melbourne. You'd like, what is Formula One even going to feel like, be like, race like? What's it like working with a full crew for the first time, doing pit stops, longer races, all of this stuff? And he's so young and he did it so well. So you nail it. Then you turn up to China and you think, okay, I'm a legend. I'm one of these guys. And just a few things went wrong for him. He was still looked quick, still looked sharp, had poor reliability in a couple of spins. But I had a decent debut in Melbourne, and I know exactly this feeling. You turn up to the next race and you think, I am one of the best. And then you're like, oh, okay, maybe I need to keep working at this because they are actually moving on the whole time. And then in Japan, he was actually really solid again and did a great job in qualifying and missed out a bit in the race. But I think the reset, just to think, okay, and breathe, because it comes at you so quickly, all of this Formula One life is so busy when you're into the run of it. We should have had 5 Grand Prix by now, and it goes by in an absolute flash. So just having a chance to absorb everything that you've learned and kind of like restart from scratch. He's still got the points on the board from Melbourne, but he just couldn't have a chance to compute what went right, what went wrong. How do you tidy up those rough edges on the other Grand Prix? I think it's perfect for a rookie, this.
It's a bit like, you know, JP, you can relate to this, I'm sure. When you do a 2-day test in a new car, right? So the first day, it's all very overwhelming. You're sort of just trying to keep your head above water. You feel like you're drinking from a fire hose, trying to take everything in. You go to bed, you sleep on it, you wake up, you come to the track the next day. When you get in the car, it all feels like second nature. Everything you've done just sort of happens automatically. This is like an exaggerated version of that. You know, those first 3 races happen in pretty quick succession. So much is happening. So much is being learned. Now you've had a chance to sit back, let it all digest, let it really ingrain into your brain, that muscle memory stuff. When they get back in the cars in Miami, I think a lot of that stuff will feel a lot more second nature, especially to a driver like Lindblad, who doesn't have to unlearn habits and procedural things from an old car and is, again, like you say, just young and learning this Formula One way. So, I think you're right. I think it's been probably a very welcome break for him.
And he is a sponge. He's actually my guest on this week's F1 Beyond the Grid out on Wednesday. And I was really impressed by him. He's confident without being arrogant, and he wants to learn. He's a bright cookie.
Tick, 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 tick. All of that is the best thing you could hear for an 18-year-old.
Well, what about the bottom four? Audi, Williams, Cadillac and Aston Martin have had the most to gain during the break since Japan. How much progress are they going to make? Do you expect the pecking order among them to change? What are you expecting, guys, from the bottom four?
Of that group, you'd hope that Williams makes the biggest jump, right? It sounds like a lot of their issues come from a heavy car, and time helps solve that, right? That will give them, all the engineers back at the factory, a chance to shave some weight off it, and hopefully that's just instant pace. They've got the power unit in the back of that thing. It just needs, you know, some help in the weight. The drivers were saying, yes, the balance isn't great either, and it's probably missing a bit of downforce. But again, with the structure that James Vowles has built there, you'd like to think that of those four teams, they're probably going to make the most jump. Next, you know, you'd hope that Cadillac, just being kind of as far down as they were, knowing immediately where the weaknesses are, it's pure downforce for them. First time they'd run a car, first time they'd raced a car, lots learned. Hopefully, again, some low-hanging fruit there that they can improve on. Audi, it's tough to know because, again, they're probably trying to continue to improve the power unit. They're going to obviously push for upgrades on the chassis. They've had a little bit of turmoil. I don't know if that's an unfair term at the team. It's become destabilized a little bit with the change in management, with Jonathan Wheatley walking out. So that kind of makes you worry about where their progress is going and how much they can make. And then obviously Aston, who knows? I mean, they could be exactly where they were. They could be mildly better. They could be 2 seconds faster because they were so far off to begin with. That one, I think, is the biggest question mark and hardest one to predict.
Yeah, I agree. Williams, I think that they didn't really have excuses at the start of the year, but they certainly don't have excuses not to actually just correct their sort of wrong turn that they've taken at some point with this. And it's been, what, 9 weeks since the last preseason test? So they, at the very least, they obviously missed the Barcelona running, but at the very least, they would have realized exactly where they're at when the car hit the ground. And you think there's got to be something coming in all of this time, plus the month off, to put on the car, to shed weight, to find downforce. They've got a load of issues all up and down the car, but they have to be a team that can move forward. They're the closest probably to do that, other than Audi, who have their inherent issue with the starts. And I don't know if that'll be fixed, although the slight tweak of the rules might fix a little bit of their start issues as well with the use of the MGUK if you don't get off the line at all well. So we'll see how that pans out for Audi. That might salvage a place or two for them because their starts have been hideous so far. Cadillac must be able to add downforce. You know, they have a Ferrari power unit. That's a great baseline. It's not the best power unit. It's very competitive at the front. It's leading every race. So that's one part. That's the complex part of this year. The next part is just adding downforce. Now, I'm not a car designer. I have no qualifications in this at all, but they have a lot that they can find. They have people that are very well equipped with great qualifications to do the job. They have Pat Simmons. They have Nick Chesty. These are, you know, brilliant designers of race-winning, championship-winning acclaim. So they have to be able to add some downforce. I'm not expecting them to get with the pack, but I am expecting them to make a leap in Miami. Finally, Aston Martin. Who knows?
Well said.
Yeah, but so the lead time on the power unit is obviously longer than the 5 week gap. But you talk about Cadillac having good people to put development on the chassis. Well, you have to say that Aston have that as well. So I would expect the chassis to have improved since Japan at Aston Martin at the very least.
100%. They have Adrian Newey there. He was late to the project. That's, you know, part of the long unfurling of their excuses is that Adrian was late, but you have to believe that because the guy has got an amazing CV. He's one of the geniuses of the sport all time. So they will catch up on the chassis. But the problem is the power unit is just such a big issue where they have to run it even detuned to get any level of reliability out of it. And they're still trying to figure out, or they were still trying to figure out exactly what was going on as Japan. And I don't know how they could have done that without putting the car back on the track in the meantime. So Adrian can work his magic, but it's going to need a lot more than that to get the car into any level of competitive order. That's the problem.
Back to school starts now. Get long-lasting battery life on the Dell XPS laptop powered by Series 3 Intel Core so you can work from anywhere. Now starting at $699 with exclusive student pricing starting at $599. And it's lightweight, portable, and packed with enough processing power to make multitasking a breeze. So say goodbye to distractions and hello to more free time, because you've finished your work faster. Complete your setup with savings on select monitors and more must-have electronics and accessories. Limited time deals and free shipping on PCs and more await you at dell.com/deals. That's dell.com/deals.
Now, Hinch, you talked about the management changes at Audi and Jonathan Wheatley, team principal, leaving after the Chinese Grand Prix. That all happened. But actually, news at the end of last week is that Alan McNish is coming into Audi to stabilize the camp. He's now their racing director. He's got great Audi heritage. He's raced for them for 25 years. He's been the team principal of their Formula E team. He won the World Endurance Championship for Audi back in 2013. He's in charge of their driver development program. So he's been embedded inside that team since the start of the Audi project, quite frankly. And he's now being recognized as the guy leading the team trackside, which is very much what Jonathan Wheatley was doing when he was there. So I feel things are starting maybe to settle down actually at Audi, and we might start to see them make a little bit of progress with McNish there. I worked with him in the past at the BBC. He's got a great racing brain. There's nothing he doesn't know about the sport, let alone Formula One. So I'm really pleased for Alan first, but also I think he's a great appointment. I think he's an Audi man. He's got Audi DNA in him, if you understand what I mean by that. But he thinks like the management at Audi, or perhaps the management are thinking like him, more to the point.
Yeah, I mean, this appointment is great. I mean, I completely agree. He checks all the boxes. He has all the experience. Because he hadn't been as forward-facing on the Audi program, I almost feel like his appointment here was sort of like his F1 driving career, where it was maybe a bit later than it could have been and sort of a little bit out of nowhere. But again, well-deserved in both cases. And I'm super excited for him, and I'm super excited for the team and the direction that he can take them. Because as you say, he's got all the qualifications, bleeds the brand, and that's absolutely, I think, the right call. But as we know, you know, somebody stepping into that role, that's not something that you see changes instantly, right? That's not an overnight adjustment. He's got still a lot to learn for that specific role, and he still has to start, you know, feeling out where they're at, feeling out where, you know, he thinks he can make a difference and what changes he wants to see. So I think in the short term, there'll be a little bit of growing pains just as that all, you know, that dynamic comes together, how he and Bonotto work together. But ultimately, I think long term, it's a brilliant play from Audi.
Just as drivers, did you prefer reporting to an ex-driver yourself? Did you feel they understood your needs better than someone who hasn't actually been in the cockpit?
It helps. I always did. I liked driving for former drivers, for sure. You know, I raced for Michael Andretti for a long time. That was always a good boss to have in that sense, because you speak the same language. They've had that experience. So I've always kind of liked having that dynamic. I don't know about you, JP.
Never had it. Always had, Fred Vasseur, Cyril Abitbol. Always had non-drivers. I would have liked to report to a driver, because you do talk, the language is just slightly different, isn't it? When you report back to a driver and they get what you're saying in fewer words, I feel like you could just do a little hand motion and they understand what the car's doing. And for my money, there's not enough former drivers that are team principals. Used to be a bit more of a thing, didn't it, back in the day? You had Jackie Stewart taking over at Stewart Grand Prix. You had Alain Prost taking over a team. Niki Lauda, of course. It's been a long time.
All the TPs are moving to engineering backgrounds, which we
Bring
certainly
back
do
drivers.
Not have.
Yeah.
But guys, I'm not even talking about from an engineering point of view, from what the car's doing. It's more, you know, outside of the garage in a way. It's kind of like, guys, you know, here we are. How are you dealing with the pressure? I know what you're feeling. Can we sort out, you know, the logistics better for you? It's almost, do they understand that bit?
Oh, 100%. 100% TC. Because they've done it. And McNish has been there. He's raced in Formula One. He knows it was, 25 years ago now that he raced in Formula One. But the sport is changed in many ways. But the logistics side of it, you know, dealing at the high level when you rock up to a race weekend, all of the things that you have to deal with, all the pressures, all of this stuff, the media, the sponsors and partners. And he knows what it's like. And he, again, just understands what a driver's feeling, which if you haven't raced in Formula One, I think it's difficult to fully grasp it. And he's a smart guy as well, Alan McNish. I think he's a great hire, because he's been around, as you say, he's been around motorsport for such a long time. Anyone who's had his success at Le Mans is a thinking driver. He's a smart, intelligent guy that can work out things on the fly and adapt. And I think he's the obvious hire. He's a great hire.
Now, one final bit of news before we go to Miami is that Formula One is going back to Turkey next year. And if you've only just started watching Formula One, Istanbul Park in Turkey is a brilliant racetrack, a modern day classic. It was on and off the calendar between 2005 and 2021. And the 9 races we've had there previously have always been exciting. It's going to be back on the schedule from 2027 to 2031. 5 years of racing back at Istanbul Park. JP, you race there in GP2. Talk us around the track. I mean, I immediately think of Turn 8, but there's a lot more to it as well, right?
Yeah, it's such a cool circuit. It's one of the all times for me. It's like undulation that you don't really get from the TV, but it's everywhere in the whole first half of the lap. Blind apexes, little crests, and then you drop down, super fast approaches. You've then got Turn 8 in the middle of it. But, you know, even into Turn 8, you're coming quite steeply up a hill on the exit of what I think is actually technically Turn 6. And then the long drag as well down to the final corner, downhill slightly, and then a really tricky braking zone. It's super intense. I think the drivers are going to have to up their training even more because of those fast corners, especially Turn 8, is brutal. I did my first ever GP2 main series race in Turkey. I'd never driven it before. I turned up 30 minutes of practice. It was wet, like monsoon wet, bone dry for qualifying. So I'm like, okay, it's all these veterans. What the heck is this place all about? Went out completely wide-eyed. Of course, I'd done a few laps on the sim, but these are like 2011 GP2 sims. They're not exactly state of the art. And it was a roller coaster ride, just braving it basically through all these turns. It's a serious circuit. I'm pleased to see it back.
on pole? Just can you finish that story for us?
Pole by 0.3.
Yeah, there he is.
No. I think I was top half, which I'll take for my debut. I think I was like 12th.
But it's interesting. It's thrown up just lots of interesting races. There's been controversy. You talked about the breaking point into that sort of last section, I think, of Vettel and Webber making contact in 2010. Of course, it's where Hamilton sealed his seventh world title back in 2020. That race, Lance Stroll was on pole position for it in the wet. So it's a crazy racetrack for throwing up odd results in many ways.
And you love that. I mean, you love having that kind of track. And I feel like we've seen that at sometimes that's Hungaroring, sometimes that's Monza. You know, you've seen some impressive performances at some of those places. But it's always good to have one that's, you know, a little bit of an outlier, a little bit of a roulette wheel, because people love seeing a shock result.
The racing there as well is fantastic. So you've got that really long run. You've got out of turn eight, then you've got a left-right chicane, difficult to pass. But then there's the long run to the final three corners, big braking zone. But the amount of times you can sort of swap places, trade paint a little bit through there, and then you get another chance to do something into turn one, and then you're whipping up the hill towards turn three. It's like this switchback heaven at Istanbul. So it's a driver's favorite simply to go round. I think this was one of Herman Tilke's best circuits that he made. It's really very good.
Can we have one little F1 Nation request to Stefano Domenicali? Can we not go there in November? Do you remember in COVID, the races were in November and it was really cold?
Good race though, TC.
Can we make it a summer race?
It was a good race. I thought you were going to say, can we have one F1 Nation request? Can we do some laps in the car? Let's all go around and record one of these around the circuit.
Now you're talking.
Yeah, some Pirelli hot laps with you two, please. I'm right in there. Look, let's break it down finally, guys. So I want you, for the main Grand Prix, you know, we'll do the sprint as well, actually. Sprint and for the main Grand Prix on Sunday, back in Miami now, give us your podium. Sprint, first of all.
All right, so I'll do sprint first, so you can do Grand Prix first then. I still think, you know, Mercedes come with the slight advantage. So even with all the upgrades, you got to figure them out first. So their baseline's the best. So let's say for sprint, it's still a Mercedes 1-2, and we'll throw Lando in there for P3 because he's been quick at Miami in the past.
I'll go with that for the sprint. I think I can see, it's George or Kimi, take your pick. I can see George coming out of the blocks quite quickly and taking the sprint. But then throw it forward to the race, and I'm just going to go curveball. I'm going to say McLaren get on top of this. You had Oscar second in Japan, and I'm going to say Lando gets a clean run through Miami. He's had the win there in the past. New car, punchy McLaren, and they show us what they're capable of. So Norris takes a bit of a surprise win ahead of the two Mercedes.
I was just thinking, are we underplaying this whole Ferrari start advantage in a sprint race, right? Because if you can get out front and there's no real strategy and you can just stay out there, maybe a Ferrari wins the sprint.
And which one, Hinge?
I'd say Leclerc, street circuit connoisseur, so to speak. But I don't hate your Grand Prix prediction. It's so hard because even when other teams have had good starts or good races going, you know, Mercedes have always still kind of found the way, haven't they? So I'm almost more inclined to kind of revert to more of the outlier results in the sprint with maybe a Ferrari victory, and maybe it's a Mercedes, McLaren, Mercedes in the Grand Prix.
Mercedes have got to see if they can get off the line still, because if they can get off the line, then they will be obviously still difficult to beat. But if they can't, and you've got these upgrades coming on Ferrari and on the McLaren, they kind of came through with a bit of difficulty in Japan, obviously needed the safety car for Kimi. But, you know, they have to learn to get these cars off the line. What are you going for, TC?
I'm on the JP McLaren bandwagon, but I think Piastri, I've been really impressed with him this year. You know, okay, he's only started one race.
But it was a good one.
In his own words, when we actually start these things, we're pretty good at it. But every time he's been on track, he's been really impressive. I feel he's had the edge over Lando. I know Lando's had lots of technical troubles, but I like the cut of the Piastri jib. So I think if the McLaren is there or thereabouts, Piastri won in Miami, of course, last year. So he's my bet. Well, guys, as ever, thank you very much for your time, JP and Hinch. Great to talk it all through, and we can go racing again at last.
Thanks so much, buddy. Always a pleasure. And yeah, cannot wait. Cannot wait. Happy to be there too. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, looking forward to it. I'll see you guys out there.
All right, we'll see you there. And you can catch JP and Hinch on F1 TV and the F1 YouTube channel for all the latest from Miami. And as I said earlier, my guest on F1 Beyond the Grid this week is Racing Bull's Arvid Lindblad. And the latest F1 Explains is all about what happens inside a garage during a Grand Prix. That's right below this episode on the F1 Nation feed. Now we'll be back, F1 Nation will be back next Monday with our review of the Miami Grand Prix. But for now, thank you very much for listening. F1 Nation is produced by F1 and Audio Boom Studios. This episode is sponsored by Honda. Since its first Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix, Honda has always taken what's learned on the track and used it to build better cars for everyone. From pushing limits in F1 to engineering the next generation of hybrids like the Prelude Hybrid and Civic Sedan Hybrid, Honda proves that racing doesn't just inspire innovation, it drives it. And that idea of taking lessons from the racetrack and applying them to road cars has always been a part of Honda's DNA. Decades of engineering in the demanding world of Formula One have helped shape the performance and efficiency you see in Honda's road cars today. And now that same thinking is shaping the next generation of hybrids as well. Cars like the 2026 Prelude Hybrid and Civic Hybrid show that electrification can be both efficient and genuinely fun to drive. The 2026 Prelude Hybrid and Civic Sedan Hybrid are engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Prelude and Civic and the latest innovations at honda.com.